This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it is with great pleasure that I present one of our favorite guests, always a great interview, on the occasion of the release of a brand new book. He's Dr. David Perlmutter, author of Grain Brain and integrative neurologist and lecturer and really someone who's at the forefront of research in how our environment, our diet, even our gastrointestinal tract has an impact on our brain function. And he's got a great new book called Brain Maker. It is just out. And I want to thank you, David, for joining us, because I know it's a very, very busy time for you. You're going to be all over the media with this book release. And it's great that you're getting the word out. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Ron, for having me. And I really want to say that this is always a great venue for me, because I don't know how to say this, and not to offend anybody, but I don't necessarily, for your listeners, have to modify the information dramatically to make it understandable, because you've got such a highly sophisticated audience. It makes it really a great moment, so I appreciate being on.
Well, great. Yeah. Also, you know, you're so used to, and you do a beautiful job of this, but, you know, it's soundbite journalism. You know, you've got, 4.5 minutes on Dr. Oz, and you've got to make your pitch. And sometimes the message has to get abbreviated. But also, you had a great forum. You recently completed a PBS special. Tell us about that.
I will. The PBS special, oddly enough, is also called Brain Maker with David Perlmutter, MD. And I recorded it day before yesterday, before a live audience, and it was just really a great experience to be able just to stand in front of individuals and speak for an hour, just giving first an overview as to the very incredible new science that explains what a role our gut bacteria are playing in terms of our overall health, in terms of various mechanisms of disease that we deal with, like inflammation and immune modulation and detoxification. And then beyond that, taking that to an understanding of not only how you can remain healthy by paying attention to this information, but also reframing how we look at various challenging diseases, even from a neurologic perspective, in terms of what is going on with the gut, relating that back to the brain, the so-called gut-brain axis that many of us have talked about over the years, but now is absolutely front and center at our most forward-thinking, peer-reviewed literature, institutions. And it's a very, very exciting time, because it's a time of great empowerment. You know, when we understand that 99% of the genetic material within our bodies is not our own wonderful 23,000 genes, but it's the bacterial DNA, the DNA belonging to the 100 trillion bacterial organisms that reside within our intestines, call our intestines home, then it becomes a very different playing field when you realize that, at least from even that perspective, the DNA in our bodies is mostly bacterial. And we understand that we are mostly bacterial, that those bacteria outnumber our cells 10 to 1, and they're living within us. They are creating any number of chemicals that directly influence our health and well-being from moment to moment. They help us harvest vitamins and nutrients. They maintain the integrity of the lining of the gut so that our gut does not become permeable to chemicals that can induce inflammation. That these bacteria are involved intimately with our metabolism, helping to determine whether we are fat or lean, and even manufacture the very neurotransmitters, the happy chemicals like serotonin and dopamine, that moment to moment modulate our mood,
the gut bacteria are doing this, it is hugely empowering because it is setting the stage. It's opening the door to absolutely a revolutionary way of thinking about health, and even beyond that, thinking about brain health.
Well, in fact, you are the editor of a brand new medical journal. I think this is a first. It's the Gut Brain Journal or something. Is that, am I capturing
the
title correctly?
Well, you know, I had my vote and it actually became the Brain Gut Journal.
Oh, okay.
So no favoritism there, but hey, you know, 30 years in neurosciences. And we are looking at how and when to make that happen. It's currently on hold. I think that the publication of that is waiting, I think, for sense that the scientific community is ready to look at that. But certainly the number of publications coming out looking at the microbiome, looking at the gut bacteria, is astounding. I mean, I'm sure you're doing your best to keep up with it, as am I.
Yep.
But just day to day, the amount of research that's being published is incredible and focused on direct relationships to disease process, which is really just breathtaking. Suddenly, we identify changes in the diversity of bacteria, specific populations being increased while others are decreased, that tend to identify correlation with things like Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, and even autism, recognizing that we're now almost able to fingerprint the various species of bacteria living within the gut that correlate with autistic spectrum disorder. Wow, it's breathtaking. I mean,
well, so you even have a chapter, a subchapter in your book that's entitled, you know, I don't want to be offend any of our listeners, but it's the word that rhymes with spit for brains.
Indeed, and
so this is a family show, so we can't say that word. But you know, what's that all about? Is that you're talking even the potential that in the future, you know, we now treat Clostridium difficile diarrhea with fecal transplants, but do you foresee a point where we may use selective seeding of the intestinal tract with fecal contents to normalize the flora so that we can alleviate various types of disorders?
Let's take a step back and take a deep breath and get our arms around what you just said. You just said, do we envision a time when reestablishing appropriate gut bacteria will be implemented to treat brain disorders? That, what a notion. And the answer to the question is we've already done it. We've actually published in the book treating autism with fecal microbial transplant. And I want to take a step back and just set the stage for that. So we know that the microbiome is disrupted.
It is what it sounds like, right?
It is. I'll get there. And yeah. And we know that what we see in many autistic children is overgrowth of clostridial species. In this case, it is Clostridium histolyticum, another species of a clostridial species. And as you've absolutely correctly described, the treatment of choice for Clostridium difficile diarrhea is fecal microbial transplant, taking purified fecal material from a screened healthy donor and infusing that into the colon of an individual whose gut bacteria need to be reprogrammed. That is the treatment of choice for C. difficile being performed now in over 150 hospitals here in America. Now, understanding that we know that the gut is disrupted, that we have what is called dysbiosis in autoimmune conditions, inflammatory conditions, and in autism, then we begin to conceptualize an aggressive treatment. Why not consider reprogramming the gut bacteria as aggressively as we can using this technique of taking fecal material from a healthy donor and infusing it into the colon of a child with autism? As a matter of fact, Jason is a child, 10-year-old.
By the way, I think some of this research is actually being done at my alma mater, at Albert Einstein College of Medicine at the Kennedy Center.
Well, as a matter of fact, yeah. The University of Arizona has just finished recruiting children for fecal transplant, double-blind fecal transplant procedure to treat autism. Who knew? Hmm. Well, we've already done that and have a child with dramatic results. This child couldn't speak very well, single words, very socially inattentive, and he's been treated. His videotape now after treatment, not that it was tape, his video after treatment is on our site, drperlmutter.com, with his story that is in the book Brainmaker. We describe him, and it's a new world treating autism, treating multiple sclerosis with fecal microbial transplant to press the reset button on the gut, on immunity, on inflammation, and on autoimmunity.
I know there's actually been some work on MS using worms, Pio Valley, the various types of, quote, harmless parasites that sort of it's like a diversionary tactic for the immune system. So the immune system doesn't attack the gut and doesn't attack the brain. It works in colitis and it works in neurological disorders. So, you know, it stands to reason that there's
beyond a diversionary tactic to work on the thesis of molecular mimicry, where you're trying to have the immune system necessarily react to something that you're putting in as opposed to reacting to the brain or the joints or the gut. What we're looking at is stabilizing the gut lining, because that plays such an important role in regulating inflammation and immunity. But beyond that, let me expand the concept just a bit. We now understand that there are specific changes in the gut bacteria in large groups called Firmicutes and Bacteroidetes that correspond to things like type 2 diabetes and even obesity, that there is a pattern of gut bacteria that is identifying type 2 diabetes. And that said, a lot of the work has been done by a researcher in Amsterdam, Dr. Max Neudorp. And what he's characterized the gut, and beyond that, he said, okay, I want to fix the gut in humans with type 2 diabetes and see what happens. So he spoke at a symposium we were at Harvard in September of last year, and demonstrated his results in treating 250 diabetic patients compared to controls, a double-blind study. And these people received fecal microbial transplants from healthy donors, and their diabetes parameters went away, improved. So basically treating type 2 diabetes by resetting the gut bacteria. That is, you know, that takes your breath away. It's unbelievable, and it's, again, as we started off, you and I, what a leverage point. So I'm chairing a symposium in Hollywood, Florida in the fall, dealing with the microbiome and these techniques that we're talking about. And I'm really excited that Dr. Neudorp is flying in from Europe to be one of our presenters and will give us an update as to where he is with his research. So what an exciting time.
Indeed, it is. But, you know, these are techniques that are sort of sci-fi techniques or techniques that are in research stages. In your book, you actually offer practical information, news you can use for people who want to apply some of these principles. In fact, there's a whole section of your book that's devoted to the notion of repopulating the gastrointestinal tract, not just with commercial probiotics. Those are good, but you place emphasis on dietary fermented foods. Tell us about that.
The idea of introducing good bacteria into the gut in the form of probiotics really dates back to the origin of this whole process of fermentation. And as best we can determine, this has been going on actively in terms of creating these products for at least 7,000 years. When a food is fermented, this is the process by which the bacteria that do fermentation, that convert sugar into lactic acid, carbon dioxide, things like that. But it allows these bacteria to metabolize sugar and to also replicate, in other words, increase their population and do good things. So we talk about fermented foods that are becoming more and more popular these days, like the traditional Korean dish called kimchi, which is really delicious, really rich in probiotic bacteria, the bifidobacteria, and to a lesser extent the lactobacilli. Kombucha tea, which has become so popular, you see it in health food stores. It's even on tap now out in Oregon. I was there last week.
You could even make a sort of a beer from kombucha.
That's right. You can. It has a
it actually tastes beer-like.
It does. It tastes like an ale.
Yeah.
Cultured yogurt,
And it's sort of close to what, you know, our forebears used to have when they had ale. They actually had, they were getting probiotics from their fermented beverages, you know, back in the Middle Ages. That's what they had.
That's right. And so we've been, and even prior to the active process of creating fermented foods, you know, I don't mean to be distasteful, but in the process of food rotting, it does tend to ferment on its own. Mm-hmm. So that said, we've been exposed to this type of dietary intervention, if you will, for a long, long time. But I would say even dating back much longer, humans have been aggressively eating what are called prebiotic foods. And prebiotic fiber is, like all fiber, indigestible type of fiber that then is helpful in augmenting the growth of these bugs, in nurturing the growth of the bacteria that live within us. So, you know, it's been estimated that our hunter-gatherer forebears would be consuming 130 to 140 grams of prebiotic fiber on a daily basis, whereas now the average American is consuming only 5 grams. So I make a big deal out of welcoming back to the table foods that are rich, specifically not just fiber, but what is called prebiotic fiber, things like inulin and fructooligosaccharides. And these are foods like jicama or Mexican yam, artichoke, garlic, onions, leeks. These are foods that are naturally very, very high in inulin and therefore are nurturing the very gut bacteria that you want to keep going. And beyond that, you know, you can go to the health food store and buy products that contain FOS, fructooligosaccharides. We're seeing a lot of products now at the health food store that are supplemented with what is called acacia gum, which mm-hmm. comes from, oddly enough, the acacia tree in sub-Saharan Africa. And this is an incredibly valuable way of amping up the growth and sustaining the growth of good gut bacteria. So
it's a prebiotic.
It is a prebiotic. And so that the addition of probiotic foods to the plate and prebiotic foods to nurture the bacteria growth, this is the way to press the reset button and really rejuvenate the gut bacteria and leverage this new information to regain health. So, you know, you and I have had a discussion thus far about this aggressive move called a fecal microbial transplant. And for your listeners, to be clear, I don't perform that procedure. And I only bring it to your attention so that you can see what the end game can be in terms of yep. reestablishing gut health in terms of its clinical manifestation.
It illustrates the power of that intervention.
Exactly. And it shows, in addition, what the gut can do, what the gut is normally doing. It justifies that, and it shows what a good gut does when it goes bad, but also shows how, hey, in a few weeks, you can get right back into the game. We present a very interesting case in the book, and also his video is on drperlmutter.com, and I actually included it in the public television program we filmed 2 days ago of a man named Carlos who came to see me, 43 years old, with multiple sclerosis. He could barely walk. And he had aggressive probiotic treatment at first and subsequently went to a clinic in England and underwent himself also fecal microbial transplant and regained the ability to walk without a cane. Astounding. And, you know, that's been published in peer-reviewed literature. Dr. Barodi in Australia has already published cases of reestablishing immune health by targeting the gut bacteria, not loading these people up with steroids. That is, it's primitive, and it treats the smoke and ignores the fire. The problem with these brain disorders is not in the brain. You know, somebody once asked Slick Willie Sutton, why do you rob banks? And he replied, because that's where the money is. So people would say, gee, brain disorders, you should be targeting the brain. Well, this may very well be why we've made no progress in developing cures for these very issues, because the problem isn't in the brain. It's very well in the gut.
Your latest book, Grain Brain, was a true bestseller. I mean, tell us about the statistics on that. That really stayed on the bestseller list for an incredibly long time, correct?
It did. It was over 52 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. and is now in 27 countries worldwide. It's in its 24th printing. So, boy, people really wanted to get this message and embraced it, the notion of low carbohydrate and avoiding gluten. You know, obviously there was pushback from those who say that, no, you know, carbs are great, fats is what's going to get you in trouble, and this is a bunch of hullabaloo about gluten, that if you don't have celiac disease, have at it, eat all the gluten you want. But the reality is that since that book was written and then published, we have been so supported by follow-up articles and new studies coming out indicating that this idea of non-celiac gluten sensitivity is gaining traction in the research community, and the idea of low carbohydrates is becoming front and center. You know, when the United States Government Nutritional Advisory Committee came out with their report about 2 months ago and indicated that, you know, as a matter of fact, dietary cholesterol is not going to have any impact on your heart, and that the big culprit in the modern Western diet isn't fat, it's carbs. That was a very validating moment because, you know, there's a terrible pun, that really went against the grain. It really went against the mainstream. And I think it's very, very important to push the envelope, and how wonderful it is that that contention that we offered up 18 months ago is now receiving such widespread validation.
Well, you've been very influential on this front, and I think a lot of people are adopting a gluten-free diet. And for some, this may not be necessary, but for a fairly high percentage of people, they feel better. And even patients who have profound neurological disorders sometimes find relief. So you've done a great service. But there's been some pushback. There's some statistics that demonstrate that people are buying less bread because of this phenomenon. I mean, it's really become
as
a
they
cultural
should.
Phenomenon. I have here a press release from a guy who I won't interview. He's author of a book called Grain of Truth, and he wants to come on my program to tell us about how beneficial whole grains are and how the vast majority of people can do fine with pasta. It's just, you know, this tiny phenomenon of the 3 or 4% of people who have celiac disease.
Well, I would say to you, why wouldn't you interview him? I mean, you know, one of the good, you know, wonderful things about your interviews is you don't necessarily always agree with your guests, and I think that's how you move the needle. I think that's how you move the ball down the field. I mean, if we all agreed with each other all the time, there would be no progress. So we really need conjecture, and maybe there is a grain of truth to what he's saying. I think it's certainly valuable to look at that and hey, consider it. You know, be prepared to counter his arguments if you feel that's necessary. But I think it's really good.
Do you feel that there is a possibility that there is a subtype of people who are not vulnerable to the effects of gluten, or even vulnerable to the effects of a moderate amount of dietary starch and carbohydrates, and that there's maybe genetic selection for sensitivity to that? So that, you know, when people read the book Grain Brain, it might be recommended that we all get into a very low carb diet, and all of us get off of gluten. But this one size fits all approach may not be satisfactory for the population as a whole, but maybe the answer for a significant number of people.
I would absolutely consider that. I would say that by and large, we understand that humans have never eaten carbohydrates. We never had wheat fields. We never had apple orchards. We never had orange juice containers hanging from trees. So when we understand retrospectively that the human genome has been refined over a couple of million years to respond from an epigenetic perspective to the environment, which includes food availability, that it has molded itself to allow our survival to this day to have this conversation based upon a set of circumstances that didn't include carbs and didn't include gluten. So from that perspective, I could dig my heels in. But I never dig my heels in to the extent that they can't be extricated, because I couldn't make progress if that were the case. There was a time in my distant past that I was writing about vegetarianism and the evils of eating meat. And I have obviously
we share a background on that because I recently wrote a blog, "Confessions of an Ex-Vegan." So, you know, I think it's kind of like most thoughtful individuals who are interested in diet, they've explored that avenue,
without a doubt. And I think what we understand now is it's not at some level whether you're eating meat or not. In terms of looking at the statistics, if you read a book like the China Study, Dr. Campbell's work is excellent. And there is clearly significant increased risk of health issues in people these days who are eating meat. But it really depends on the type of meat that they are consuming. It'd be like doing a study saying, well, we're going to determine the effects of alcohol in a person and not delineate between a person drinking a glass of Merlot versus having a couple shots of scotch. So the same thing goes with meat. And I am really in favor of people allowing themselves some grass-fed, organically raised beef. It totally conforms to the type of foods we've always eaten, as opposed to this industrial grain-fed, GMO corn-fed, antibiotic treatment, glyphosate food treated that they're giving to these animals, the consequences of which in their flesh and in their microbiome are very, very worrisome, to be nice about it. It's not fair to say that meat eaters means those people, because you're going to generate statistics from that type of diet that are absolutely devastating. So I think it's very important to be very clear about where these statistics are generated from, and welcome back to the table things like grass-fed beef, wild fish, not farm-raised, eggs. Eggs are back. Eggs have high levels of a chemical that was so castigated for so many years, cholesterol, which is the raw material from which we make vitamin D, cortisol, testosterone, progesterone, estrogen. We need cholesterol. In my business as a neurologist, I thrive on looking at statistics that demonstrate, for example, that in elderly people, those individuals with the lowest cholesterol have the highest risk for dementia. So it's time. I think the level playing field is one that will embrace peer-reviewed science. So, gosh, I'd encourage you to interview I guess it's probably the book you're referring to is Stefan Yaffa, and interview him.
Yep.
And have at it. And gosh, I would join that conversation as well, and would be willing to hear the other side of the story. That's how we make progress.
Well, that's great. I really appreciate the spirit of that, because
Sure,
I think all too often I think the battle lines are drawn in nutrition, and people, you know, it's kind of like politics and religion. You know, it's like you can't have a conversation. And, you know, this is supposed to be science, and we're not supposed to be ideologues. You know, we may carry a banner for our particular theory, but as scientists, I think we have to always be open to new data, which can change our minds. So that's
no
great.
No question.
All right, this is a good this is a good point at which to pause, because we divide our podcast into two parts. Save that thought. And folks, join us for part two of today's discussion with Dr. David Perlmutter. He's author of a brand new book just out, Brain Maker: The Power of Gut Microbes to Heal and Protect Your Brain for Life. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.